Hello, everybody, and welcome to the February 2012 edition of the SANS and its Storm Center's monthly threat update. My name is Johannes Ulrich, and just as a reminder, these webcasts are archived. So if you go to the sans.org/webcasts page, you should find a link to archives. PDFs will be made available usually within a couple hours after the webcast concludes. We also started offering them as a podcast now. If you want to download them to your iPod, probably will take till tomorrow or so to convert it, and you will have to subscribe to the monthly podcast feed on the isc.sans.edu website. The podcasts are audio only, so not 100% sure how well this will work for you. The archives that you find on the sans.org websites, they are actually recorded in Illuminate here, and you get the full experience, audio and slides. With that, let's get started by thanking our sponsor here. Core Security Technologies is the sponsor for this month's webcast. They're not going to speak here, so all will be just content, and would like to acknowledge their contribution to this webcast. So what do we have to talk about? This is one of those rare months where we do not run the Wednesday after Patch Tuesday. We keep the webcast always on the second Wednesday of the month. Well, this month, the second Tuesday actually is next week when we'll get Microsoft's patches. So I usually take the opportunity to step a little bit back and look at sort of some of the larger issues. And the one sort of core topic this month will be secure email access. And I want to sort of highlight a couple of the issues that come up there. Not really a great solution, actually, I'm going to offer, but some of the architectural issues and so to consider as you build your own. With that, the reason I'm covering that is that we have seen a lot of sort of notable email breaches lately, and that's sort of where this not so advanced persistent threat fits in. Secondly, I want to talk about disk encryption, because that has been sort of an off and on topic, and just some sort of new releases last month about that again. So I want to point out some of the issues that come up with disk encryption. So first, let me sort of introduce this not-so-advanced persistent threat, because it's really something we do hear a lot about, you know, all last year that sort of kept coming on and off. And really, what it's usually about is sort of this hacktivism. I mentioned some of the groups here, Anonymous, Lulzsec, AntiSec, and such. And what they're really doing, and that's sort of where the name is kind of associated with, is they're not necessarily using great new zero days, for example, to attack organizations, or very sneaky attack like what's usually associated with the advanced persistent threat, where you have sort of custom malware being written, infiltrated via very cleverly designed phishing emails and such. Well, that's not really what this hacktivism or the not-so-advanced persistent threat is about. However, what they do have in common is that they're very persistent. So the way this manifests itself is that they pick very large targets. So, you know, one of the early ones was Sony. Sony has a huge network. Lately, like last year, there was, for example, a hack against a site, an InfraGuard website down in Atlanta. Well, that site is sort of associated with the FBI. And if you know, just say, hey, we are going to attack some site that's in some way associated with the FBI, well, you, of course, will end up scanning a huge number of sites, and you will find a weak link, like in this case with this InfraGuard site in Atlanta. Now, okay, that's... actually, I think I'm not advancing the slides here. Sorry for that. So, that's really the problem here, that you have these huge networks, and they're really impossible to defend in that sense, that there will be a system that's vulnerable to very basic attacks. Now, where these groups then, again, excel at, and where the persistency comes in is how they leverage these breaches. So, for example, in the Atlanta case, they broke into the InfraGuard site. Nothing really much in there in the InfraGuard site. You know, pretty much anything InfraGuard does is more or less public. But what they got was they got a list of email addresses and passwords from that database. Email address and passwords that were used to log into the site. And then they figured out that some of these companies use the same email address, same password to log into webmail and email systems. So that's how this relatively minor breach then escalated to become a major leak of email that was then exposed. The other sort of a difference between this not so advanced persistent threat and the advanced persistent threat is that the advanced persistent threat is all about remaining hidden. So the malware writers that create this sort of custom malware go to great length to hide the fact that they infiltrate a network. With the hacktivism part, of course, part of the point is to sort of shame these organizations. And as a result, they're usually, you know, very open in exposing what they found. They usually don't stay in a network very long, however. So the persistent part is not really about how persistent they're infiltrating the network. But after they're in there, after they get what they want, then it's sort of about exposing the breach and in some ways really just shaming the organization that got hacked. So some of the exploits you may typically see there is SQL injection. Now, I always say in my web development security classes that SQL injection is one of those totally unnecessary vulnerabilities, but it's everywhere, in particular if you're looking at older applications. Unencrypted passwords are another sort of very basic security vulnerability. One of the pushbacks I sometimes get in class is, well, why do you talk about that? You know, everybody knows about it, but lots and lots of people still make those mistakes. And then, of course, once they're inside a system, you know, sometimes it's just simple password guessing, for example, SSH password guessing and issues like this, then they start exfiltrating data. So, you know, documents, for example, these passwords that are not encrypted, they're then trying to reuse them. And then, of course, the insecure communication like email that's then exposed once the password is reused and email is accessed. And why does it really work? You know, why do these simple vulnerabilities still work? Everybody should know by now that it's important to encrypt your passwords or hash your passwords, and you know, that SQL injection has to be avoided, that you can use prepared statements and such as a fairly simple workaround for that. But with the problem here is the imbalance in resources, that as someone in charge of security for that network, you are fairly limited when it comes to time. However, these hacktivism groups have a good number of people that essentially do nothing but scan for a fairly small number of security vulnerabilities. With that, of course, the attack tools have become pretty simple. And really what it comes down to with the attack tools don't have to work every single time. In particular, in this case, they can miss now, most of the SQL injection vulnerabilities in a particular website. However, all they need is they need to find one in order to then get your passwords. Even a professional pen tester is at a disadvantage in that sense, that a pen tester is usually expected to enumerate as many vulnerabilities as possible, not just to take a vulnerability and run with it. So this is really one of the sort of basic asymmetries you have here, that as a defender, you always have to get it right. As an attacker, you really only have to find one vulnerability. You can get it 99% of the time wrong and miss most vulnerabilities if you find one that then gives you access. Yeah, and then, of course, where again, the time and somewhat the creativity of the attacker matters is how is a relatively small breach leveraged to provide more substantive access. So, and with that, the one sort of common problem that came up in addition to web application security, and we have talked, in particular last year, a couple times during these monthly thread updates about the web application security challenges here. So that's why I decided to focus somewhat on what I think is actually almost a more complex issue, and that's email security. And here just a couple of examples. Very recently, like the last couple of weeks, I'm not sure if you saw it, but for example, there was an email that leaked between the FBI and Scotland Yard where they were setting up a conference call to discuss their advances in prosecuting anti-second associated groups. Well, details about that particular conference calls leaked in the email, and with that, of course, now the attacker had access to the conference call and recorded it. Another big one was a few gigabytes of a confidential email leaked from a lawyer that currently defends a soldier who is accused of war crimes. H.B. Gary, I think, is sort of one of the early poster childs here in how that all sort of can cascade. Again, a simple SQL injection vulnerability in the content management system on their website was used to access passwords that were not encrypted, and then those same passwords were used to access email systems, and email was downloaded. Yeah, and I put here sort of as a last bullet, there are many, many more, and just look at the news. I think there's one at least every week, and if you check Pastebin and these typical sites where the information is leaked, you probably don't have a problem finding things like email and such that got leaked. So why is email so hard to secure? In part, it's the architecture of email. First of all, you have a number of different devices that can originate email. Then email is forwarded not end-to-end, but sort of in the store and forward process. Typically, you first send it to mail submission server, so that server will just receive the email. It will then forward it to the mail server of the recipient. That may then forward it to an IMAP hop server or maybe a webmail server that provides then access, and again access to a wide range of devices. So there are a couple problems with it here. First of all, you don't have the end-to-end connection. You have a variety of devices, and then email is typically stored on systems that are directly accessible from the outside. And all of that really contributes to making email a fairly hard to secure part of your infrastructure. Then there's also really no sort of widely accepted standard to encrypt email, for example. There are really two standards that I would say are somewhat accepted, and that's SMIME and PGP. However, neither one of them is really in wide use. There's some SSL encryption between email servers while it's in transit, but typically that does not affect that how email is stored on the server. And then you have various clients being used even by one user. I find that, for example, to be challenging. You have your laptop, you have your desktop, you have your mobile phone all connecting to the same, let's say, POP server. If you, and they continuously poll that POP server. So if you change your password, what has happened to me, for example, is I change my password on my desktop, but then my cell phone and my laptop keep polling using the old password and lock me out of my account, because then you exceed the number of login attempts. So it's really tricky to coordinate that all correctly and prevent the lockout and still being able to regularly change your password. The other thing is sort of the constant access. I mentioned the polling. You want that. You know? You don't want to enter your password every single time you check your email. So that's another sort of contributing problem. Now the security of mobile devices becomes more of an issue because they have to cache your password in order to provide that continuous access. In particular, if you have a complex password on a mobile phone, you don't want to enter it every single time. So you either use a simple password or you cache it on the client. And of course, then with mobile use, you have the use of email across insecure networks. I'm sitting in a hotel here right now and I'm using the hotel network. Well, who knows who else is using the hotel network? So wireless networks, another big issue here in airports and where else you're sort of checking your email. You kind of blindly trust these networks. And this is one of the key reasons why people like this ubiquitous network access is to check email. That's probably sort of one of the killer features that people use mobile devices for, aside from Facebook check-ins. So the problem, just to summarize, is the store and forward nature that neither the sender nor the recipient typically controls the path. With a website, if I allow you access to a website, I can configure my website to require SSL. And with that, I can make sure that all clients that connect to my website do use SSL. Well, I can do that for my mail server, but it really is only enforced from whatever mail service it connects to. It's not enforced beyond the next hop. And with that, you know, all the different devices that you typically have to support and all the different access methods that you do have to support. So just a little bit for clarification here, the different entities that you typically have involved as email is moving around a network. Typically, you're talking about a message submission agent. That's the mail server that receives the email. So you would typically connect to your ISPs, to your corporate mail submission agent. Then it's sort of being handed across various message transfer agents or MTAs. Historically, in particular, message submission agent and message transfer agent has been sort of one entity, but more recently, that's more split in particular for all the spam filtering, virus filtering and such that people do. And then, of course, also the message user agent, which is the client that you actually use to download the email or to create the email. And then we have a number of different protocols that are involved. SMTP, of course, is sort of the backbone of email. That's how email is sent and forwarded between different hosts. Yes, there used to be other protocols, but really, so I'm sticking here with the modern SMTP-based, IP-based email. So like the UUCP and the Unix-to-Unix copy protocol and a couple of older protocols. They may still stick around some networks, but really, for the purpose of this discussion, aren't really all that important. Then POP and IMAP for the end user, for the mail user agent to actually pick up mail or in some cases send mail, like with IMAP. Then, of course, you have other sort of non-mail protocols that are involved. I mentioned webmail earlier, so that would involve HTTP and HTTPS. And then sort of to make it work all together, DNS. Yeah? DNS is how you find out what is the MX record or the mail exchanger that you have to send a particular email to. And then, of course, DNS is also sometimes used for certain security features with an email, for example, to publish keys and such. So DNS always plays a role whenever we talk about IP-based applications. Now, of course, one thing we could do to secure the email in transit is the use of SSL. All those email protocols, SMTP, POP, IMAP, they can wrap in SSL, and that's probably the most widely supported security feature if you're talking about these email protocols. The problem is, how is it implemented? And that's always the big SSL question. What I find is that most mail servers, if they offer SSL, they do not offer valid certificates. You see a lot of self-signed certificates, in part, I think, because, you know, there is no error message popping up in some kind of browser. So, like you have an HTTPS, but it's an obscure error message in the log that you may see if the certificate turns out to be invalid. And I've experimented with that, but pretty much you cannot enforce valid SSL certificates and still sort of maintain email connectivity. There are just too many mail servers out there that do not offer a valid certificate. And if you would require a valid certificate, then your email would essentially just no longer work. The other part, of course, is it's really only server to server. So, or client to server, it only protects one hop, and you don't really have control on how the email works once it is being received by a mail server. That mail server then may decide to forward it without SSL, or maybe a receiving mail client decides not to use SSL to connect to its POP or IMAP server. So you really, as a sender, you only control the first hop, and as a recipient, you control the last hop, but nobody really controls the connection end to end. Yeah, and then of course, with SSL not being used here for authentication, because, well, you use invalid or self-signed certificates, that opens the door to man-in-the-middle attacks. So while it makes it a little bit harder, it's very possible to do a man-in-the-middle attack against an SMTP server typically, because it will not check the certificate. Now, a couple other sort of authentication schemes that are in somewhat wide use. There is domain key. Domain key came out of Yahoo, and the main purpose of domain key was really to fight spam. One of the problems you have with spam is that people claim to send email on someone else's behalf, so you can't really just filter by the from address, because people could use whatever from address they want to use. And that's sort of what domain key kind of tries to address. With domain key, the mail server signs the headers. So now you are actually able to validate that this mail server is authorized to send email on this domain's behalf. Now, the way these key works is that the public key part is published via DNS. So as a receiving mail server, I can query DNS, figure out whether or not that domain uses domain key. If so, then I can check whether or not the headers are signed correctly. But the only thing this does is it authenticates the headers. It does not protect the message from tampering, or it does not encrypt the message itself. So the message itself is still wide open out there for everybody to read and intercept. Similar scheme is the Sender Policy Framework, or SPF. Now, the Sender Policy Framework is a little bit simpler than domain key. Domain key typically requires that you patch your mail server, so it will add these signatures to the header. With the Sender Policy Framework, we don't really have to do anything at all to the sending mail server. All we do, and again, we do this with DNS, we publish a list of mail servers that are authorized to send mail on our behalf. And these lists can be created rather easily, just as a text record in DNS. So just any mail server that may send email on the behalf of your domain, you may add to that list. First of all, this is again being used to fight spam. It doesn't do anything to having the message or the headers being altered in transit. Doesn't authenticate who sent the message. It really just limits what mail server is allowed to send mail on a particular domain's behalf. Now, another variation that you have to the SSL with email is start TLS. Start TLS is in so far a nice scheme that it doesn't require the use of SSL from the start. So what you do is you connect to your mail server on port 25. You ask it, do you support SSL? If so, then you switch over to SSL on that same connection. Theoretically, that protocol start TLS can be implemented via other protocols, like you could have start TLS with HTTP. However, I haven't really seen any implementations of that. The only place where I have sort of seen start TLS being implemented is email or SMTP. However, you know, it still has all the other SSL issues that we had before. It sort of just allows a client or a user or a server to improve the security of a connection by opt-in on SSL. So it's really more an opt-in to SSL than requiring SSL. Now, just to compare the two end-to-end encryptions, these are really the only two mechanisms that you have that protect the message end-to-end. And that would be something that the sender has to do. So the sender, for example, signs or encrypts the message using S/MIME or PGP. Now, S/MIME, I think, is at this point the mechanisms that's implemented more widely than PGP. You can typically find PGP plugins for various mail clients, but by default, you will usually find S/MIME already in your mail client. S/MIME is based on certificates just like SSL, so has all the problems that SSL certificates have. You have to validate them, who is actually handing out those certificates, and so essentially you need some form of PKI, some form of public key infrastructure that needs to go with it. Now, there are a couple of entities that will give you a free S/MIME certificate. Komodo, for example, if you do a Google search, will give you one that validates your email address. Better than nothing, probably, to use one of their email certificates. It's really easy to implement even on mobile devices, like iPhone as of iOS 5 does support S/MIME in its native mail client. So you don't need to install any additional software or such. All you have to do is you have to configure S/MIME, which really means that you download a key or a certificate into the iPhone. And that's also not that hard to do, actually. All you have to do is you have to put up that certificate on a website, point your browser in your phone to the website, and it will automatically offer you to import that certificate, and then you can use it on your phone. Now, PGP is probably an older algorithm or scheme than S/MIME. Even though S/MIME is implemented more widely, personally, I see PGP used more. I think in part because people who are aware of the need of encrypting email are usually sort of more linked to the PGP heritage and already have PGP keys. Now, with PGP, you do not have the usual hierarchy that you have with SSL. With SSL, we have these top-level certificate authorities that basically tell us whether or not something is good. We have to trust those certificate authorities. With PGP, each key may be signed by any number of additional keys, and it's really up to the user to decide which keys to trust. That's great for us, sort of the more a geeky crowd here, but doesn't really work at all for a wide public deployment because how is the average user going to figure out what key to trust and not to trust unless we make sort of these key signing parties more sort of public events or such that sort of limits kind of the adoption of PGP. So with S/MIME, the user has to obtain a certificate and can only encrypt an email if you already have the certificate of the recipient. So you may be able to search for it and find it, and then you trust it because it is signed by a certificate authority that you trust. It does not work well for mailing lists and such because in addition to the message, it also protects the headers. And for example, if you have a mailing list that rewrites the to header or such, then the certificate validation will fail and you will get a warning. Your BGP does authenticate and encrypt. Now, how much it authenticates and encrypts depends somewhat, but typically it just encrypts and authenticates the body of the email. It doesn't really do anything for the headers. However, most implementations will verify that the to header matches the actual, or the from header matches the email address associated with this particular key. So again, there can be issues if the email is being rewritten by mailing list software or such, but other than that, it works pretty well. It does require this web of trust, so you need to know what signatures to trust and not to trust. And the problem is it's not as widely implemented as S/MIME, so it's a little bit harder to roll out. Now, then there's sort of the one elephant in the room, kind of, and that's web-based access to email. So now, essentially, what there's also two ways to implement it. You could do it internally. You essentially set up your own web mail system, and there are couple of open source and for pay implementations like Outlook Web Access would probably be a big one, or it could be publicly hosted like Gmail, and we'll talk about sort of the cloud-based approach there in a second. Now, it has advantages and disadvantages to do it this way. The disadvantage, of course, is that now you have to worry about all of these web application vulnerabilities. So they now essentially translate to the web environment. In particular, cross-site scripting has been a very common attacks against webmail systems. Now, there are advantages to it. The biggest advantage probably is that it really takes the client out of it. The client is now a web browser. So now the server part is more in charge over how the email is read. So the server can enforce now SSL. The server, if it's done right, can refuse caching of the data on the client, and the email itself stays on the server now. So in particular in mobile environments, you don't have the issue where people carry their email around with them. However, they probably still want to be logged into that website for convenience. You lose some of the push capability of email, so you in order to check whether or not you have email, you have to check the site and you sort of lose the offline use of email. So it has its pros and cons. Another nice thing about the webmail approach is that your email retention policy, for example, can now be enforced on the server because the email does not reside on the client. So the server can decide when to delete emails, when to back them up, how to do offline backup of email, for example. So that gives you a little bit more manageability here with webmail. And it's certainly, I think, an approach that should be considered. I don't say it's the right approach for everybody, but it certainly has its advantages. Yeah, and then of course you have the cloud-based approach, which I see as a specialized case of the webmail system, where you host your webmail with a public provider. The biggest issue here is that now they're in charge of your email security. So whenever they do something right or wrong, your email is affected. So what are kind of some of the recommendations I have for email security? First of all, I think this is complex enough an issue, you can't really have a one-size-fits-all approach. So I definitely think you should investigate S/MIME and PGP. If you do, I highly recommend that you do at least sign all of your email. Again, look at compliance issues here, sometimes in Europe, or for example, there may be issues with signing all email. But one of the biggest mistakes I find is that people try to sign only important email. The reason I think it's a mistake is that in order for this to work, particularly for the trust to work, you need to establish sort of a history that I'm sending you signed email. So when I send you the important email, that's not the first time you see that particular certificate from me. So that's why I say do it whenever possible. Also encryption, encrypt whenever possible. And then of course, if you do it, if you implement SSL, use valid SSL certificates. Now, online email storage, difficult question. How long should you keep it around? Again, compliance matters here. In some industries, you have to keep email around for a certain amount of time. But typically, that archiving can be done offline. It doesn't have to be online. But then again, just to do business, I need to be able to go back for a while to check on an email that I sent or received a while ago to, for example, look at what that particular contract exactly look like. Yeah, definitely look at webmail solutions. I think they have some advantages there, but be careful in how you configure them and test them carefully. Yeah, and then of course, consider a two-factor authentication. If you are doing S/MIME, well, then you need some form of PKI anyway. So using certificates to authenticate may be a reasonable option to do it relatively easily and user-friendly. So that is definitely, again, something to consider. Google, for example, for its webmail, of course, uses two-factor authentication. And if you do use webmail, again, that may be a little bit easier to implement and to enforce than on a standard mail clients. Not all mail clients do support two-factor authentication. So that could be a problem there. So anyway, so much about email and a couple ideas here on how to secure email. But with that, let me move on here and spend the last few minutes we have on the second topic, and this is attacks on disk encryption. One attack that, again, last month sort of made some news is FireWire. Now, this is not a new attack. The problem with FireWire really is that it allows direct memory access, and with that, it does expose your keys. So the other reason, of course, that disk encryption becomes more and more of an issue is because it becomes more common. More and more people understand that it is important to secure your mobile devices, and it also becomes more and more available. Like OS X Lion now included full disk encryption. Windows 7 includes full disk encryption. So it has become now widely available. So people are looking more into how to attack it. Yeah, so how does disk encryption work? And I'm talking about full disk encryption here with sort of a pre-boot authentication. The way it's usually implemented is that as you initialize it, as you basically tell your system, hey, I want to encrypt my disk, it creates a random key. That key is typically not exposed to the user, so the user has no idea what that key is. Sometimes it offers to display that key so you can back it up. For example, if you do, you should do that offline. You know, copy it to a USB stick, print it out for that matter. you will only need it sort of in emergency situations. But that's the actual secret that's then used using some standard algorithm. And I mentioned AES here. That seems to be the most common one to encrypt the disk. Now, that key itself is encrypted using a passphrase. And the advantage of that architecture is that you could have one secret and multiple users. Each user uses their own password to encrypt that key. Because in particular with full disk encryption, each user on that laptop needs to have access to the entire disk and needs to have access to that encryption key. So this is really sort of how it usually works. So the features of this is that you can have multiple users. If you want to delete the disk, erase the disk, all you really have to do is you have to erase the key. And that's, for example, what the iPad and iPhone is doing when you remote wipe the disk. They're actually not wiping the disk, they're just deleting that key. And once that key is done, then if you assume the algorithm is secure, there is no real way to get the content of the disk back. Even if you then know the password that the user used to log in, it still is not going to help you because there is no key to decrypt using that password. So the attack with FireWire is going after this secret. So FireWire is this direct connection to your PCI bus. As a result, FireWire has complete read and in some cases write access to memory, to your disk. What these attacks do is they do download a copy of your complete RAM, and that's actually usually what takes the time. Like one of the recent attacks quoted about 40 minutes to capture the key on a Mac, and then it searches the memory downloaded for that key, and essentially just knows what area of the memory to find that key in. And once you have that key, then you can use it to decrypt the content of the hard disk. So the tricky part now is, how do we hide the key? How do we prevent this attack? From an attack point of view, of course, the tricky part is finding the key. What are some of the countermeasures here that you can use? Well, you could disable FireWire, epoxy the port, but then again, you just paid a lot of money for a laptop, and probably one of the features that you looked for was that it had a FireWire port. You could remove the drivers, the FireWire drivers, but that again would kind of disable too much. Some cases you may be able to disable in a BIOS, but I don't remember seeing that in a laptop recently. But it's very possible that some laptops allow that. Now, a better way is to remove the encryption key from memory if it's not needed. So, for example, when the system goes to sleep, and that's when you're most at risk. Like, it's unlikely that someone walks up and connects a FireWire reader while you're working on your system. The more likely attack is while the system is packed away and locked in your hotel safe or whatever, that at that point someone will attack it. And that is possible. What that usually requires is, your memory needs to be powered down during sleep. So you put your system more in a hibernate mode than a sleep mode. The disadvantage of this is that now whenever the system wakes up, you need to enter your password because it needs to, again, decrypt the key. And the other result of this is that it takes a little bit longer to recover from sleep because it needs to restore the memory from disk. So that's a disadvantage. Yeah, and like I say here, entering your password is probably a good thing anyway, but the delay on my MacBook, I do that, and the delay, even though I have an SSD, is sort of 10-20 seconds. So after I put the system to sleep, when I wake it up, it needs about 10-20 seconds to recover or restore the memory from an SSD drive. Other solutions that have been prevented and implemented and in some cases, for example, storing the key in protected memory where the FireWire doesn't have access to. That has been implemented with some of these trusted computing modules that you see in some laptops. Windows 7 can take advantage of that, for example. Sometimes you can limit the access to memory from FireWire. Check your operating system whether or not it allows you to do that. Now, in the other threats section, now Intel and Apple at first came out with a new port, Thunderbolt or Lightspeed, I think is the Intel brand name of it. Right now, it's mostly on Apple laptops, but Sony and other manufacturers start picking up on it too. This is essentially a new version of FireWire. FireWire is PCI. Thunderbolt is really more the more modern PCI Express, PCIX version of FireWire. So it has the same issue where a device that's connected via FireWire has direct access to the bus with that direct access to memory. I haven't really seen any implementation of that attack for Thunderbolt yet, in part probably because there isn't enough around yet to really make that a worthwhile attack. And I believe at this point, all systems that have Thunderbolt also have FireWire for the most part. Well, maybe some of the MacBook Airs, I think, don't have a FireWire. They only have a Thunderbolt. Okay, so we are up at our 45-minute mark here, and with that, I would like to conclude the webcast for now. Any questions before I sign off? If you'll have any questions later, feel free to use the email address here, handlers@sans.edu, or just the contact form on the ISC website. Also, I already mentioned our monthly podcast. We do have a daily podcast as well with a quick news summary. And Adam started to write up sort of a feature of the week to showcase some of the less known features on the ISC website. Well, with that, if we don't have any questions, thanks again, everybody, for listening. And talk to you again next month. Bye.